At my house, we love to read. And I'm curious, I'm sure many of you like to read, but how many of you are in particular really enjoy biographies? Put your hand there if you really enjoy reading biographies. Yeah, yeah. But you know, biographies are pretty much all the same. You realize that. They start by telling where the person was born, what their parents were like, what their childhood's like, and their adolescent years, and then how they were formed into the person they were so that they would go on and do whatever event or whatever great thing that they did. And they would talk about what their life was like afterwards. And then usually if they've passed away, they'll talk about their death and their ongoing legacy. But the biographies that we have of Jesus are very different than that. Yes, we have a brief story of how Jesus was born and the circumstances around that. We have even one small, very small story of Jesus at about the age 12 going to the temple. But after that, we got nothing. In fact, most of the biographies of Jesus are concerned with just the 3 years of his ministry. And then half of the biographies deal with just the final week of his life. Very different. And of course, this is the week that we remember. Jesus' triumphal entry into Palm Sunday, his gathering with his disciples for the Passover meal on Maundy Thursday, and of course, his betrayal, arrest, and crucifixion, and death on Good Friday. This week is Passion Week. And it comes from the Greek word pascho, which means to suffer. Which is why Mel Gibson, when he titled his movie, The Passion of the Christ, because the movie's all about Christ suffering. And so this is the week, Passion Week, in which we remember the suffering Jesus Christ went through. But it's not enough for us to simply recall that Jesus did suffer. We need to remember why Jesus had to suffer, that he must suffer. And it's that word had and that word must that throws you for a loop, as it did Peter and his disciples, and Jesus' disciples, when Jesus said this to them. We read this in Mark 8:31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he had to be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Now, of course, Peter is representing all the other disciples when he hears Jesus say this and begins to rebuke them. Imagine that, him rebuking Jesus. And this reminds me of a similar time in my life when I was a freshman at Hillsdale College, and one of my theology professors, his name is Dr. Michael Bauman, he was discussing Jesus dying on the cross, and I raised my hand and said, why did Jesus have to die? Why did he have to suffer? Why couldn't God just forgive? I mean, God is God. He can do whatever he wants to do in whatever way he wants. That's one of the privileges when you're God. Even Jesus in his humanness struggled with this question. In the Garden of Gethsemane, after he had his last supper with his disciples, Jesus, sweating blood, cried out saying, Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Everything. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. And of course, Jesus received a silent no to that prayer. No, the Father would not take away the cup. Jesus must suffer and die. So we ask again, make sure I get hitting the wrong one. There we go. Why did Jesus have to die? On the one hand, we know why Jesus died. On the human level, of course, he was a threat to the ruling religious leaders and to the Romans. So killing him was a way to remove that threat. That's simple enough. And on the heavenly level, spiritual level, we know that Jesus died to take away the sins of the world. Take away the punishment for our sins. And provide a way that we could be reconciled to God. We know that's why Jesus died. But on the other hand, we have to ask again, couldn't God have done it a different way? Couldn't he have accomplished all this without the suffering and death of Jesus? So the question remains, not why did Jesus die, but why did Jesus have to die? And let me suggest two possible reasons why Jesus had to die. The first is that real forgiveness always involves costly suffering. Real forgiveness always involves costly suffering. I remember when I was, probably about third or fourth grade, and we were at my grandma's house for Thanksgiving. And my cousin, who's the same age, and I went outside, and we found an old Michigan license plate. And we thought to ourselves, well, that shouldn't just be left here. We should throw it at something. Ah, my grandma's neighbor's house is right there. There's their garage. Let's throw it at the garage. And being in third and fourth grade, my aim is so great that I hit the window and broke the window. And I wasn't as Christian as I am now, although I don't know, maybe I would still do it today. I ran. I got out of there. My cousin and I, we were out of here. You didn't see it. I didn't see it. We're not saying a word, all right? Well, my neighbor saw it, or my grandma's neighbor saw it, and he went and talked to my grandma, and it didn't take long to put two and two together. That was my cousin and I. Now, here's the situation. This neighbor could make me pay for the window. I broke it. He could make me or my family pay. Or he could forgive us and not make us pay. But what's the problem there? You still have a broken window. And either he has to leave it broken or he has to pay to fix it. But either way, someone has to pay the cost. Now, I grant you that many times in life, when we suffer hurt and pain, nothing tangible is broken. But that doesn't mean a cost isn't incurred. I remember when I was in fifth grade, my mom was out talking in the yard with another mom in the neighborhood, and I was riding my bike, and I remember riding up to my mom, and my mom, for some reason, started to tease me in front of the other mom about some girl she thought I liked. Now, in fifth grade, that's a no-go. You don't do that. You don't do that. I was deeply embarrassed. I was just shell-shocked. Of course, the other mom's sitting there like, oh, well, who's this girl? And just, it's killing me. Now, there was no price tag I can put on that, but I had a deep sense of hurt, of being violated in some way. My own mom. I felt that the wrongdoer had incurred a debt to me that I couldn't simply brush away. Now, I had two choices. I could forgive, or I could make her suffer. I told you I wasn't so Christian back then, and I decided to make her suffer. I was feeling embarrassed. I wanted her to feel the same embarrassment, so I said back to her when she started teasing me about that girl. I said, that girl? Mm-mm. She's a... And I'm not going to say the word that I said. Because that word got me grounded for 3 weeks. If I said it now, I'd be grounded for another 3 weeks. But she felt embarrassed. You could see the look on her face. She was suffering in front of this other mom who's like, oh my. In those old plays, the southern women, oh my, something like that. That's the look that she was giving my mom. But those are always the two choices. You can make someone suffer or you can forgive. And of course, when we make someone suffer, we do it sometimes by withholding our relationships from them. We pull away or we actively seek to hurt them in one way or another. Or if we can't actively do it, we passively wish it upon them. But of course, when we do that, what happens to us? We become bitter, harder, colder, more selfish, and a lot of times it leads to cycles of retaliation. I've been hurt, I hurt you back. They feel hurt, they hurt me back. And it goes on and on. Revenge has a way of making things worse, not even. When you try to get payment through revenge, the evil, of course, doesn't disappear. It spreads to others, to yourself, and into your character. But there's another thing you can do besides making them suffer, of course, and that is to forgive them. But this is not an easy thing to do at all. Those of you who know this, who've been really hurt, it's not easy to forgive. To refrain from lashing out at someone when all you want to do is get even with them, that is a form of agony. That is a form of suffering. In fact, it's worse. It's double suffering. Because you are already suffering the original hurts of what they did to you, and now you're suffering from not having the opportunity to get even. That is double suffering. You've been hurt twice. And forgiveness, of course, feels like a kind of death, because you've got to kill that opportunity to get even with them. But it's a death that leads to resurrection. Because instead of developing attitudes of and habits of bitterness and cynicism and coldness, you have an opportunity to live in love. So we ask again, why couldn't God just forgive us? Well, nobody just forgives. That's clear, right? Nobody just forgives. Forgiveness means bearing the cost instead of the wrongdoer. Real forgiveness always involves costly suffering. On the cross, we see God doing visibly and cosmically what every human being must do to forgive someone, though, of course, on an infinitely greater scale. And that word visibly is key. Because even if we grant that forgiveness is costly, why did Jesus have to suffer and die like this? And that brings us to the other reason why Jesus had to die like this. The cross was God's way of showing us three realities that we would not otherwise have been able to really see or really understand. And those three realities are the heinousness of sin, the weight of God's glory, and the extent of God's love for us. And we're going to walk through those three things. The heinousness of sin, the weight of God's glory, and the extent of God's love for us. So, the heinousness of sin. I'm wearing a wedding ring. I bet many of you are as well. Now, of course, you don't have to be married to wear a wedding ring. You know, some guys try to pick up girls by wearing a wedding ring so they're committed and then say, oh, just kidding. I don't know how that works, but... But of course, a wedding ring, if you truly are married, this wedding ring tells others a truth that's internal to you. And that truth is that I have made a commitment to my wife, that we are married, that I am hers, she is mine, you know, for the rest of our lives. A wedding ring is an external symbol of an interior reality. Well, in the same way, the cross is a visibly external way of showing the internal heinousness of sin. Sin at its heart, of course, is saying no to God. Sin seeks to do things the way we want to do them, when we want to do them, however we want to do them. Sin's desire is to put ourselves in control and to cut ourselves off from the very source of life, which is God himself. The cross is a visibly external way of showing this heinousness of sin, as was the animal sacrifices in the Old Testament. God, of course, required the Israelites to offer animal sacrifices for their sins. They had to visibly see this is what sin does. It kills you spiritually. I remember in Sunday school, I was teaching an adult class, and we were looking at the Old Testament sacrificial system. And if you've read that, parts of Leviticus especially, it gets really gory. It gets really detailed. And I remember one woman just having this look of disgust on her face. And she finally had enough to say, I don't like this. This is just awful. This is terrible. And I turned to her, and my response was like, finally, somebody in the class gets it. That's exactly the response you should have. This isn't supposed to be pretty. It's supposed to make you feel disgusted. It's supposed to make you hate sin. And what it does to us and what an affront it is to God. It's supposed to make you realize that the suffering and death of this animal is exactly what sin is doing to your soul. The awfulness of seeing that animal die is just a taste of the awfulness of the eternal death that you can't see that's caused by sin. The awfulness of Jesus' suffering and death on the cross is a visible display of that heinousness of sin. But fortunately, the cross displays much more than just the heinousness of sin. It also displays the weight of God's glory. Now, what do we mean by the glory of God, the weight of God's glory? Well, the glory of God refers to all that God is. It is the beauty of his character. It is the greatness of his power. It is the goodness of his love. It is the purity of his holiness. It is the justness of his righteousness. It is the greatness of God's being, the perfection of all his attributes rolled up into one. That's the glory of God. Thus, the glory of God is the worth of God. It is the value of God. So when we praise God, when we speak well of him to others, we bring God glory. When we make sacrifices, when we give of our time like we're doing this morning, or when we give of our money like in the church offering, we are telling God and others that God means this much to me, that he is worth the sacrifice. And this brings God glory. Of course, sin does the opposite. It takes away God's glory. When we disobey God, we are essentially saying to God that you are not that great. You are not worth obeying. I don't value you enough to give of my time, my energy, and my resources to you. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say you, if you think back, if a little older, remember, think back when you had kids, little kids. And let's say you overhear somebody else praising your kids. They don't know you can hear them. And they are praising your kids. Oh, boy. Your chest puffs out. You are feeling top of the world. This is, yeah, I'm doing something right. I am a good mom. I am a good dad. Yeah, yeah. They're praising your kids, not you, but you get the glory, right? Now, let's say you overhear them trashing your kids. And they don't know you can hear them. Oh, my goodness, that kid. Oh what a crazy kid. Who are his parents? What is going on? You know, you're destroyed inside. It kills you to hear that. Another example, I remember a country song. Of course, this probably sums up most country songs. But this country song was about how a guy had to decide if he was going to climb the water tower in his town because somebody had graffitied some awful things about his sister. It's pretty much every country. Something like that. And there was a pickup truck and a dog. Something like that. So now, the guy's got two choices. This guy could climb up the water tower, erase it, find the guy who did this, and make him pay to restore, make him pay, you know, to do this, and therefore restore his sister's honor. Or he could just shrug his shoulders and say, yeah, my sister is kind of like that. She really isn't that honorable. And you just leave it up there. What does this have to do with God and the cross? When we ask a question like, why can't God just forgive? It's like asking, well, why can't this sister and her brother and family, why can't they just get over those graffiti comments? Come on. Instinctively, she and they know that she is of such great worth and value that they have to confront those who did it. They have to repaint that tower. They have to try to reclaim some of her dignity that was stolen. Because not to do so displays to everyone, including themselves and including her, that she really isn't worth it. That same principle applies to God, but in a very, very different degree. Because how much greater is the glory and honor of God Almighty compared to one of his creatures? The glory of God that is infinitely greater than anything else. And so sin against this great, infinite God is infinitely greater than against anyone else, this sister included. Because God's worth and his value are infinitely greater, so is any offense that would diminish, deflate, or degrade that image. But again, that's exactly what every sin of ours does against God. In essence, every sin of ours is like us climbing the local water tower and graffitiing something terrible about God. And if God were to respond to this by just shrugging his shoulders and saying, eh, not that big of a deal, what would that tell us about the importance of God, the greatness of God? If God doesn't think his glory or honor is worth that much, why in the world should we? But God does not shrug his shoulders at sin. He knows the weight of his glory, and he will act to defend it and restore it, because there is nothing of greater worth or value than his own glory, nothing. In fact, in Isaiah 48:11, we read this. God says this, For my own sake, I do this. How can I let myself be defamed? I will not yield my glory to another. This is why God cannot just sweep sin under the rug and simply forgive us. By doing that, he would be saying that his righteousness, his holiness, his love, his honor, his glory is not that big of a deal. And this is why even the animal sacrifices were not enough. In Hebrews 10, it says, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Sacrificed animals could not take away sin. That is why the Passover is called the Passover and not called the forgiveness. As you will remember, God told Moses that he was going to send the angel of death into all of Egypt as a punishment for sin. But that if the Hebrew people would sacrifice a lamb and place its blood on the doorpost of their home, the angel would pass over their house. Pass over your sin. Not forgive your sin, but pass over. Because the death of an animal could never atone for sin against an infinitely great God. They could only pass over them for now and point to a time, and this is key, when the worth of the sacrifice would be equaled to the worth of the one who had been offended, and that's God. That's worth repeating. The death of an animal could never atone against an infinitely great God. They could only pass over for right now and point to a time when the worth of the sacrifice equaled the worth of the one who had been offended, and that's God. And obviously, humans couldn't match the worth of God, which is why God forbid human sacrifices. Only God can match the worth of God. It would take a God-sized sacrifice to atone for the many offenses against an infinitely perfect God. And that is why when Jesus asked in the garden, "Is there another way?" he received that silent no. Because there was no other way. There was no one else who could match God's glory and be equal to the offense of sin that was against God himself. At the cross, Jesus, who was and is God, clothed in human flesh, incarnate, offered himself as the sacrifice for sins. Because there is nothing greater God could have given us to show his own worth and value than giving himself. So, the cross not only displays the heinousness of sin and the weight of God's glory, but thirdly, it shows us the extent of God's love for us. It's worth remembering at the beginning of the sermon, we mentioned that real forgiveness always involves costly suffering. You can make someone else pay, or you can pay it yourself. But somebody has to bear the cost. It's also worth remembering that God could have restored his glory by making us pay for our infinite offense of sin. And that is what hell is. It's ongoing because you can never repay an infinite offense. But instead, God displayed the dimensions of his love for us at the cross. For Jesus Christ, when he said yes to the cross, when he obeyed his Father and was crushed, for Jesus, the cross was his way of saying to God, "You are worth it. You are worth this much." And at the same time saying, "And they are worth this much to me as well." One of my favorite pastors who I very much enjoy listening to and reading is Tim Keller. And often when he would preach, he would do a question and answer after the service. And one Sunday, he was preaching on a subject similar to this. And a woman he didn't know asked him, didn't really ask him a question. Sometimes, you know, it's more of a statement. Like, I want to tell you something. I don't really ask him a question. And she just said, you know what? My God is a God of love. He just forgives. There is no blood, no cross necessary. And that's just awful. And Tim Keller turned to her calmly, politely, said, well, let me ask you a question. What did it cost your God to love you? What did it cost your God to love you? And she said, nothing. And he said, exactly. It didn't cost your God a thing to love you. It cost my God dearly to love me. That's how much I am worth to him. Then that's how much you are worth to him. When we look at the cross, we see the high cost God was willing to bear because he loved you that much. You were worth that much to God. As Romans 5, 6 through 8 says, you see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, no power in ourselves, Christ died for the ungodly. No, very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still sinners. And God didn't wait and say, I'm going to wait till they get their act together. And then, okay, you got your act together, now I'll forgive you. You know, I'm going to wait till they grieve sufficiently, come and beg me sufficiently. Then, no. While we were still ungodly, while we were still enemies, that is when Christ died for us. So why did Jesus have to die? There was a real debt to be paid, and Jesus paid it. There was a real dishonor to be restored, and Jesus restored it. Jesus had to die because real forgiveness always involves costly suffering, and the cross was God's way of showing us three realities that we would not otherwise have been able to really see or understand. The heinousness of sin, the weight of God's glory, and the extent of God's love for you and me. Amen.